Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, DACA recipients react to last week's court ruling that the program is unconstitutional. And later, why you need to slow down when driving through Yosemite. But first, huge wildfires are burning in the state and across the West. But even small brush fires can be devastating to local communities. As FM89's Mati Bolaños reports, residents of Poplar, an unincorporated community of about 2,200 people in eastern Tulare County, are struggling after a fire burned down their lifeline.
Aziz Hassan walks through the remains of his trailer home and the mini mart that his family has owned for more than 50 years in Poplar. On July 9th, he says, a power line that ran through a tree in between his property and his neighbors sparked.
It caught fire on this tree, the first tree. It flamed that up from on top, started going down. Once it hit the floor, then the CVA garage caught on fire.
The CVA is the Central Valley Empowerment Alliance. It's a community-based organization that was supposed to hold a youth vaccination event that day, according to Executive Director Mari Perez Ruiz. No kids were injured, but the supplies intended for them were destroyed.
We expected over 400 students to come from all over the area, and we had backpacks filled with supplies, lunch boxes. We had over $100,000 of clothing from Forever 21.
While the CVA's garage caught on fire, the only structural damage was on the roof. Still, she says the items inside the garage, including six quinceañera dresses, canned food, and school supplies, are unsalvageable.
And I recognize that even in the midst of all of this, we are one of the luckier ones.
But others weren't so lucky. The Porterville Fire Department said the cause of the blaze is still under investigation. What residents know for sure is that within 30 minutes, the fire had destroyed two trailer homes and damaged another house. It also burned Adams Market, the mini-mart that was home to four immigrant-owned businesses. They were the lifeline for people living in the community and surrounding areas.
People come from far to shop, to cash their checks, to get their hair done, to transfer monies to their families.
Families living in Mexico, Central America, and Yemen. She says most residents in Poplar are undocumented and low-income. Now, the only business left in their community is another small grocery store.
Even though we are in the Central Valley, we provide food for the world. We find ourselves in a food desert. And when one of our two grocery stores, the oldest one in town, becomes ashes, it has an impact that is beyond Poplar.
I visit the community 5 days after the fire. It doesn't smell like smoke anymore, but evidence of the fire is everywhere. A couch inside one of the trailers is burned down to its springs. Half-burnt backpacks are piled up near the CVA building. And the local business owners who gathered in the CVA tell me they are still processing the loss. Veronica Quiñones owned the hair salon in the building for 4 years. She says she was washing a client's hair when someone ran into her salon and told her the building had caught on fire.
We didn't have time to think or to try to take anything with us. In 5 minutes, when I least expected it, I lost everything.
And with four kids and a pandemic that shut down her business for months, she says she couldn't afford insurance. Now, she's not sure how she will recover.
Everything burned. I don't have sisters or even a place to work.
She's not the only one. Gregorio Rodriguez and his wife had owned La Potosina, a panaderia or bakery, for 2 years. He says it was their dream to open up their own bakery. They saved every penny they could for nearly 10 years.
Like Vero said, you lose everything, all the years of hard work, early mornings, late nights, and suddenly it's gone.
And without insurance to cover the damages, he says he's not sure what the future holds.
We were a family business. We lived off our day-to-day sales.
The Rodriguez family will need to figure out how they're going to pay for next month's bills. Cesar Leonel Cruz Chavez, who rented a room next door to Adams Market, needs to find immediate housing.
Right now, we're not sleeping there. We're sleeping in our cars.
Chavez says he works the night shift at a dairy farm 3 minutes away. That's where he showers. He then heads to his car to sleep in the record-breaking heat.
I waste more gas, but I turn on the air conditioning and, well, there I am struggling.
Marie Perez Ruiz says the Red Cross offered the displaced people $500 vouchers for hotels, but that only covered about 3 nights in the area. And she says the community is facing a housing crisis, making it more difficult for Cesar and the other 11 displaced people to find a place to live.
Finding housing, you know, the only option for many would be to move out of the community, and that's displacement, just because there's no housing available.
That's why she says she's reached out to State Senator Melissa Hurtado and County Supervisor Dennis Thompson for help. Senator Hurtado says she will do what she can to connect the community with resources. In the meantime, Perez Ruiz says the community will focus on rebuilding. They've also created a GoFundMe to help the families affected by the fire. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Among the San Joaquin Valley's community of Punjabi Sikhs, there are lots of reasons people have been vaccinated against COVID-19.
So I got it first just to see how it, like, the outcome would be. Then, like, one by one, my family got it until it was my grandma's turn.
Talked to my family. They already got it. Everybody was vaccinated already, and I was the one left. So I said, okay, if you guys are doing good, I can also do good.
I don't want to die.
But there's another reason many are getting their shots. FM89's Carrie Klein takes us to a Sikh temple known as a Gurdwara in West Fresno.
The Sikh Institute of Fresno looks much like it did pre-COVID. At this three-story salmon-colored Gurdwara, people stream in and out of the main worship hall, some in saris and kurtas, some in t-shirts and jeans. While they circle the room, a trio of men playing harmoniums and tabla drums sing hymns known as kirtan. Outside, people wait in long lines for bubbling trays of vegetable curry, lentils, and roti on the way to the langar hall, a common area where they can eat and catch up with friends. But on this day, classrooms with chalkboards and bright posters that are typically used for Sunday school have been repurposed. Sitting in one of them is 13-year-old Navleen Kaur.
A lot of people are, getting sick, and for them, we are getting vaccine, so we'll be okay. We'll not be sick.
Kaur is in the observation area of a pop-up clinic, and she just got her first dose of the Pfizer vaccine.
It was just okay. It was like someone pinched you. No, it doesn't hurt.
Her cousin Anmol Kaur, also 13, sits behind her.
Why did you want to get your vaccine?
I don't want to be sick, and I want the coronavirus to end, so that's why.
These cousins are among more than 1,500 people who have been vaccinated at Sikh Gurdwaras from Fresno to Bakersfield. Many of those were organized by Nandeep Singh, who's also here today.
What's up, Baldeep? Good. How's life after graduation?
Singh runs the nonprofit advocacy group Jakara Movement. A year ago, the organization joined the Fresno County COVID-19 Equity Project to help protect the community from the virus.
Very early on at the time of the pandemic, we had raised quite a bit of alarm bells.
One alarm bell? Very little public health information is available in Punjabi, even though it's one of the most common languages spoken in the valley, and so many of its speakers are essential workers in agriculture and trucking. at least 4 Punjabi Sikhs died during COVID outbreaks at poultry plants in Fresno and Merced counties. So these pop-up clinics are one way Singh's organization is bringing culturally competent virus outreach to his community.
We've had billboards, we've commissioned Punjabi music songs, so we've really tried sort of an all hands-on-deck approach.
Singh says the vaccine concerns he's heard from community members are common everywhere, like how quickly it was developed and its potential side effects. But many Punjabi speakers feel their concerns just aren't being addressed by health authorities.
And if you're only telling people vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate without answering their questions, people start digging in their heels after a while because they feel like they're being shamed into a particular action.
As a result, many haven't been vaccinated yet, though Singh mostly characterizes them as vaccine curious rather than vaccine hesitant. Dr. Kenny Bond agrees.
I find the Punjabi community wholly fairly accepting of it. They have less resistance to vaccines.
Bond is an assistant dean at UCSF Fresno. He runs the med school's vaccine clinics, including a traveling van known as Mobile Heal. It's hosted hundreds of pop-up vaccine clinics around the county, including this one today. He says bringing vaccines directly to these communities, staffed by people who speak their language, can help fill the voids left by conventional outreach. It's a tool that can be used beyond the pandemic.
COVID has really forced us to do things that we should have been doing for decades from a public health standpoint. And we're hoping that COVID has allowed us to create some infrastructure with these groups.
So are these clinics having an impact? It's hard to tell. Government agencies classify race in broad categories, like Asian, so it's unclear what the vaccination rate and infection rate are, specifically among Punjabis. Plus, vaccinated people can opt out entirely of self-identifying their race and ethnicity. Nevertheless, Gudi Ranu, an educator at this Fresno Gurdwara, believes these clinics are important. She's also the co-founder of the Sikh Women's Organization of Central California. And she says bringing vaccines to people where they are can be the deciding factor for those who are curious or on the fence.
Sometimes you don't even think about it. Like, my friend is having it, I'm going to have it.
Especially if that friend speaks your language and visits the same gurdwara that you do. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This story was reported in collaboration with the Documenting COVID-19 Project at Columbia University's Brown Institute for Media Innovation.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last week, a federal judge in Texas ruled that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, is unconstitutional. For now, that means that new DACA applications will not be approved, but DACA renewals will still be processed. It was the latest blow to the program, which allows more than 600,000 immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children to receive work permits and protection against deportation. To find out how local DACA recipients are responding to the ruling, I spoke to Jessica and Grizel, two sisters who asked to be identified only by their first names. Their childhood friend, Helacio Rodriguez, also joined the conversation. He started by talking about his journey to the United States.
Our family migrated to the U.S. in 2000, so about 21 years ago now. And we walked through the desert, and we've been living in the Central Valley ever since. Most of our childhood, we spent it in the rural town of Woodville. It's about hour and a half southeast of Fresno. And so we've been here most of our lives now, because when I came to the U.S., I was just 7 years old.
And what are you doing now?
Now I am an assistant engineer at a civil engineering consulting firm in Visalia.
Jessica and Grizel, I guess you'll have a similar background, but who would like to take the question?
I could do that. Our story is almost the same as Helacio's. Our family migrated over around the same time in the 2000s. I was about to be 5 years old. Grisel, she was about to be 3 years old. We came with our uncle. We came in advanced and our parents came after. When we got here, we stayed with one of our aunts, and we had never met like any other family other than the family that we had back in Mexico. So coming here, we were small. We didn't have our parents, and we stayed with our aunt, which it was very like great of her to like have us there, but it was quite a change because we were so used to like being with our mom all the time. And then when we got here, we were with our aunt, and we, even though that she's our aunt, and we like now as an adult, like, oh yeah, she's my aunt, but when we were little, we didn't know we didn't know her, we didn't know who she was, we had never met her before. All we knew is that we were told she's our aunt. So that was actually kind of scary, just because we were little, we didn't really know, and all we could think about was, or at least me, because Griselle was a little bit more younger, and we came with our other sister, who at the time was about to be 1 year old. So all three of us, we were with our aunt. And I just remember constantly, it's something that's always in my mind. Like, I remember being scared because everything was so new, so different. I didn't have my mom. I was with someone who I didn't know. And all I could think about was, is my mom going to get here? Is my mom going to come? Am I going to see my mom again? And that's like the thought that I had all the time, nonstop, until finally I saw her. And I think that was like the biggest relief that I felt. And I can still remember the feeling because it was very like, it was a very scary moment. We stayed in Porterville pretty much like our whole lives. We grew up there. We met Gelasio and his siblings there in high school. And then we, all of us, me, my sister, and like my other sister, the youngest that came with us, we all went to university, we went to college, and I graduated with my bachelor's. And right now I am working as a youth mentor with a nonprofit. I'm helping create a program for youth mentorship. And yeah, that's kind of our story.
Sure. And Griselle, maybe you could tell us what you're up to these days.
So I currently graduated from university in the December 2020. So I've been just working part-time with an after-school program with children. And I recently got a new position. I'm doing part-time for subbing as a preschool teacher. And I'm still going enrolled in school to get a permit to become a master teacher for a preschool.
Well, Halasia, I'll come back to you. What did you think about last week's ruling that came out of Texas? I mean, there's been so much up and down when it comes to DACA, and this was, you know, yet another setback. What went through your mind?
You know, actually, I anticipated the decision that was handed by the judge just because of the past rulings that he had issued for the DAPA program and expanded DACA program some years back. So it wasn't much of a surprise. Because prior to what I do now in the engineering field, I was pretty involved in the immigration field in Fresno and throughout the Central Valley. So I was pretty familiar with the different cases that were working their way through the courts. So it wasn't a surprise, but it was nonetheless still a setback, like you mentioned.
Griselle, I can only imagine how frustrating this process has been. Where do you situate what happened last week with this, you know, up and down, back and forth that we've seen with DACA?
Yeah, it's a little, can be overwhelming and confusing because it's like, we don't know like what's going to happen. Oh, well, kind of, but like, it's like it would be a huge setback. And just constantly thinking like, oh, like what's going to happen? Like, how is it going to, constantly thinking like, how is it going to affect if I can't work, or like, thinking of like, what am I going to do? Like the worriedness is there.
Mm-hmm. And Jessica, how are you doing?
So I try to stay away from the news because it can get very heavy. I talked about this with a friend like not long ago about the ruling and like the possibility of DACA just like not existing anymore in the future because of like what's going on, and because it could potentially happen. And just like what Grisel said, it's worrisome. Like the only reason I'm able to work, turn money right now to like live, pay bills and all that stuff is because I have DACA. And even though like I know that if anything, I'll figure something out, but it's still worrisome and it's still stressful having to like have that worry added on top of every other daily worries that happen, like, oh, bills, it's hot outside, or just anything, any other worry that you, any individual can have. On top of that, I worry about, well, is DACA still going to be there? And will I be able to like continue working and continue pursuing what it is that I want to do with like my life and career?
Jessica, I'm going to stick with you. What do you want to see happen now?
Well, ideally, I would like there to be like some type of immigration reform where there could be a pathway to citizenship for individuals who have DACA and others as well, because it's complicated. The whole immigration system right now, like it's not ideal, I guess. Can't find the right words to say it.
Well, Halasio or Grisel, what would you add to that?
No, I think I would agree with Jessica that obviously the DACA program was never meant to be
permanent,
to be running for so long as it has now. It's been nearly 10 years. So just to echo what Jessica said, it does get complicated trying to make long-term plans or figure out how your finances are going to work a month from now or a year from now. So because it has been almost 10 years, we've sort of built this lifestyle just with the notion that we knew we had DACA, we had employment authorization. And so we were able to afford certain comforts, but now again, with the ruling, all that again is put into jeopardy one more time as it has been before. So as far as getting something more permanent, I think there's a number of bills in Congress that have been passed in the House and then just reached nowhere in the Senate. So obviously it's a little bit more work on that needs to be done. And a lot of the Republican senators just need to be upfront about what really is their hesitation, because obviously they like to say that they're sympathetic and that the quote unquote like DACA students or the DACA applicants or the quote unquote dreamers, as we're often referred to. But yet in every opportunity they get to vote on these things, they sabotage the bills or they vote against it. So obviously there's something that is not working out right there.
And then it's scary too, because it's like there's so many people who have DACA who are doing all these jobs like Helacio, like engineer, doctors, people who if they lose their DACA, like they can't continue doing their job. And it all those individual students also who are going to college to do something big, or even if they're not like going to do something big, it still like affects their life, the future, like everything.
Absolutely. Well, I've been talking with Jessica, Halasio, and Grisel. Thank you all so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having us.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last week, an unidentified Yosemite park ranger shared on Facebook the heartbreaking account of a mother bear mourning the loss of her cub after it was hit by a speeding vehicle. The post went viral and drew national headlines, calling attention to the danger posed to wildlife by speeding motorists. To get a better sense of the magnitude of the issue, I spoke with Jamie Richards, park ranger for Yosemite National Park.
To give us some context, how common is it for bears and presumably other wildlife to be struck by speeding cars inside the national park?
So this is an important reminder for all of us when you're visiting not only Yosemite National Park, but all of our national parks. Wildlife, you know, live in the park. This is their backyard. And it's really important for all of us to slow down, follow the posted speed limit when you're in Yosemite National Park. That speed limit is there not only for your safety, but for the safety of wildlife. And we also ask you to, you know, watch the side of the road, scan the side of the road, looking for wildlife crossing the roadway. So in Yosemite National Park, at least 8 bears have been hit by vehicle in the last month. And since 1995, Yosemite National Park has been tracking the number of vehicle bear collisions that have occurred within the park. Over the course of that time, we've had over 400 bears that have been involved in known vehicle bear collisions. And not all of those are fatalities. And of the 400 that we know of, you know, oftentimes a bear is struck by a vehicle. The bear may be injured. It runs off into the woods. We may not get a confirmation of what happened to that bear after the collision.
You know, I have to say, this post on Facebook has generated so much attention. It was such an incredibly heartbreaking story. What has the response that you've seen?
You know, there's been a lot of interest and response in the American people showing their love and appreciation for these wild places like Yosemite National Park. It's been wonderful to see so many people concerned about the bears in Yosemite. And really thinking about how do our personal actions impact the environment that we're in. When we are in Yosemite National Park, you know, we are the visitors. It is the home of our black bears and all other animals that call that place home. And so we ask you to continue to remember that when you visit Yosemite, treat this place as a visitor and help us protect our friends and neighbors that call that place home, particularly our black bears and other animals that do cross the roads to get from one point to another.
You know, this is a really basic question, but I think there is a misperception out there that the work that you do as a park ranger is to serve the public, which obviously is part of what you do, but your main charge is to protect the land. Is that correct?
It's a twofold charge and a twofold mission. And as a park ranger of the National Park Service, my mission is to help preserve and protect the natural and cultural resources of that park. And it's also to help provide public understanding and welcome the American people to their national park and help them find their own place in the natural world and in our national parks. So my mission is to, you know, help the American people coming to Yosemite understand and find their own personal connections for that place. We all have a different thing that draws us to the wild, a different thing that draws us to come out and be inspired when we're in our national parks. And it's also a friendly reminder that we're not the only visitor here. This place is home to over 400 species of vertebrates, of mammals, amphibians, birds, and other species. And you know, we're visitors in their home.
To that end, more people have gotten interested in exploring nature, I think, as a result of the pandemic. And I'm wondering, have you seen any change in crowd behavior? Have people perhaps been more reckless or just uninformed about how to treat natural lands and how to behave appropriately?
Yosemite National Park receives over 4 million visitors in an average year. We haven't seen any significant changes over time in human behavior. For decades, Yosemite National Park has a program of public education to go out there and help remind visitors, how can we best interact with the wildlife that are here in the park in front of us? Reminders like, please don't feed the wildlife. Human food is not good for wild animals. Reminders like when you're in a campground, please properly store your food so that wildlife is not drawn to your campsite. These are lessons that we've been sharing with the American people for decades in Yosemite National Park, and they're important lessons that we continue today.
So there is a reservation policy in place right now to visit Yosemite. How has that been going? And do you think it's something that might continue even after the pandemic?
So there is a reservation system currently in place to visit Yosemite National Park. You go on recreation.gov and look for the day you'd like to come and purchase a day's reservation pass to visit Yosemite. This program will be in place until September 30th of 2021. So it'll be in place for the next couple months. And we're going to be continuing to gather information. The system is in place to help us keep Yosemite National Park open and manage Yosemite National Park in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we are continuing to work with our public health officials to provide a fun and safe experience in Yosemite.
Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about this phenomenon. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I'd love to remind visitors. So Yosemite National Park has had what we call the Red Bear, Dead Bear initiative that started in 2007. So when you're driving around the park and you keep your eyes open, we do have signs that are located in the park to remind us to please slow down, please follow the speed limit. And the sign has a picture of a red bear on that. And that's a reminder that is a location where we've had a bear that's been known to be hit by a car. So we continue to remind visitors when you come to Yosemite National Park, please slow down. That's the most important message that we can convey is when you're driving in the park, it's a really special place. Take the time, not only for your own safety, but the safety of all wildlife, not just our black bears, to follow the speed limit, slow down, pay attention to your surroundings. Wildlife can cross the road at any point in time. And it's up to us to take responsibility and to be watching out for them. They don't know where our car is. And for the benefit of all the species that call Yosemite home, it's up to all of us to help look out for them and to slow down when we're driving in the national park.
Well, thank you so much for that reminder. I've been talking with Jamie Richards, park ranger at the Yosemite National Park. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We'll be back with more stories after the break.
I'm Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. For years, loved ones have recorded the stories of their lives with us for our archive at the Library of Congress. But at this moment of profound political divides, we're trying something new. It's called One Small Step. We match you with a stranger with different politics than yours. And through StoryCorps, you get to know them as a human being, because it's hard to hate up close. Valley Public Radio is helping lead our effort in the San Joaquin Valley right now. Sign up at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last week, officials in Fresno joined many counties across the state to advise even people vaccinated against COVID-19 to mask up indoors. What gave rise to this change in guidance, and should we be concerned about the potent Delta variant? Here to answer these questions and more is FM89's Carrie Klein. Carrie, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here, Kathleen.
So before we get to the specifics, let's begin with a valley-wide snapshot.
Right. Well, there's certainly been more motion related to the virus in the last week than there had been for many weeks before that. So throughout the state, case rates and positivity rates are rising once again. They're both about 4 to 5 times what they were a month ago. Locally, the numbers vary a lot by county. However, even though many counties in our area have not seen the same magnitude increase as other parts of the state, at a high level, case rates and positivity rates here are rising as well. So are hospitalization rates, though hospitals are nowhere near critical occupancy yet. And when it comes to vaccines, about 43% of the Valley's population has received at least one vaccine dose, and that still trails the state average, where well more than half have received at least one dose. The state has also upped some of its analysis of the virus. And, you know, using some of their numbers, it looks like it was also about a month ago that the virus began infecting people at a faster rate. So there's this measure known as R effective, which represents how many people on average one person will infect. And it was about a month ago that the statewide estimate of the R effective rose above one, which means that for each individual person who gets the virus, they will infect more than one person in turn. And so that may reflect, you know, more contagious variants of the virus. It could also represent changes in how people are interacting with each other, including whether or not they're wearing masks.
Los Angeles County last week reinstated a mask mandate for everyone, regardless of vaccination status. Has that happened anywhere here?
Officially, no. However, Fresno's mask recommendations did change last week. So Fresno County health officials now strongly recommend that even vaccinated people wear masks indoors. That's not a mandate, though. And during a media call yesterday, I asked Fresno County's interim health officer, Dr. Race Vora, why he recommends masks so strongly but won't require them. The answer, he's being cautious about subjecting the public to precautionary measure whiplash.
So I think it's a more nuanced decision whenever you create a mandate, especially for a county that's as diverse and big as we are, where you have so many different types of activities going on. And it's really hard to ascribe just one level of risk for all the different activities that people do.
Fresno is the only county in our region making this recommendation so far. And even though the county is trying to avoid, you know, a potentially premature mandate, I think many would still argue that there is a lot of mixed messaging going on.
Absolutely. And I mean, it raises the question, why would vaccinated people be better off wearing masks anyway? I mean, aren't the vaccines incredibly effective?
I mean, yes, but there are a few answers to these questions. I mean, the first is that the vaccines were more than 90% effective against the original strain of the virus, but variants have now become more prevalent than the original strain. The Delta variant in particular is highly contagious. It's less susceptible to vaccines and less susceptible to some treatments in the hospital. And so it's important to protect yourself against it. You know, and researchers are still figuring out just how effective the vaccines are against the virus. But here's Vora again with a ballpark perspective.
With the Delta variant, because it seems to be a little bit more sneaky, a little bit more virulent, you're probably about 80% protected. That's still really good. That's still a sign of a great vaccine. But you can really push that 80% back up into the 90s if you wear a mask.
The other part to this answer is you can still share the virus even if you've been vaccinated. And yet, yes, your symptoms might be minimal. You might not have them at all. You will likely not be hospitalized. But should you contract the virus, you could still infect other people with it. So wearing a mask also protects other people in case you have the virus and don't even know it.
How common are breakthrough cases among people who've been vaccinated?
It's really hard to pin that number down, according to health officials. So Vora, once again, he estimates that around 1 out of every 10 people in hospitals right now have been fully vaccinated. But then there are those cases that don't end up in hospitals. Here's Vora again.
The harder question to answer is the people who are not hospitalized, because they could have a whole spectrum of illness. They could be completely asymptomatic and still test positive for COVID. And that kind of counts as a breakthrough infection. Or they could have very mild symptoms and then they don't notice it themselves. Maybe they just have some sniffles, maybe a tummy ache, et cetera.
So even though doctors and researchers don't have that number pinned down of these breakthrough cases among vaccinated people, they're still comfortable saying the vaccine is highly effective. Because if you do only get the sniffles or a tummy ache, that's not the severe case you could have gotten without the protection of the vaccine.
Well, can you tell us more about the Delta variant? How prevalent is it and how severe?
So based on state data, this variant has spread much more quickly than others we've detected in the past. You know, the first cases of the Delta variant were detected in April here in California. And in just 3 months, it's skyrocketed to the most prevalent variant in the state. More than 80% of all cases currently being sequenced right now are this variant. That's pretty tremendous. Now, health officials, of course, are not sequencing every single positive test result. And there's also a long lag time between when samples are collected and when the results come back. So things could have changed in the weeks in between. And it's hard to say, you know, this many people in the hospital have the Delta variant. But health officials are still attributing rises in cases and hospitalizations largely to this variant. And then CDC data also show that this variant doesn't respond as well to some treatments, including monoclonal monoclonal antibodies, which, you know, have been the standard treatment for hospitalized people so far.
Okay, so we hit upon mask mandates. Let's switch to vaccines. Any hint that vaccine requirements could change anytime soon?
Potentially, yes, if the federal government approves these vaccines for anything beyond just emergency use, which is what they've been approved for so far. Here's Vora again.
Honestly, I think that would be a huge win, is if the FDA went ahead and granted full approval for the vaccines that have had so much clinical data at this point. I mean, these are arguably the most scrutinized vaccine products in the history of medicine. And I don't know what other data the FDA needs to make their decision. But, you know, in terms of the implications, once that decision is made, whether it's in the next couple of weeks or in the next couple of months, that will actually allow us to, I think, more strongly pursue getting the vaccination requirements in different sectors. And again, you know, this is not to control people, it's to protect people.
Certainly, vaccine mandates in order to work or to go to school would be a contentious issue. But, you know, many essential workers have been asking for vaccination requirements to protect themselves and others at work. However, many others feel that's trampling their own personal choices. But you also see many institutions like schools and universities that won't institute vaccine mandates among students and staff unless that full authorization comes down. And, you know, it's looking unlikely that that will happen before the fall semester starts next month. So there's a lot that's still up in the air right now.
There certainly is. Carrie, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The city of Hanford in Kings County is celebrating its 130th birthday, and residents have filled the weekend with activities and events commemorating the milestone. To hear more about the celebration and how the city was founded, I spoke with Hanford's Parks and Community Services Director, Brad Albert.
Let's start with the origins of the city. I understand that Hanford owes its existence to the railroad. Is that right?
Yes, it does. Really, you know, prior to the railroad, really the Yokut Tachi Indians were settlers, you know, in the Great Tulare Lake is actually what this used to be. Then the railroad came in. It was actually a sheep farm. They settled here. The railroad came in, and actually Mr. Hanford worked for the railway and decided to establish a place here. So that kind of grew. And then on August, I think I've got the date, August 9th was the actual vote. It was an election to vote for incorporation as a city. So that happened 130 years ago, this August 9th.
So I understand that this weekend there's going to be a number of events happening commemorating that 130th anniversary, including a museum opening. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a 2.5-day event really to celebrate the 130th birthday, to celebrate our community, to celebrate the grand opening of the Carnegie Museum, and then really to acknowledge our veterans who serve, you know, the nation and the community. So the Carnegie Museum is the old library. And I'm not exactly sure on how old it is, but it's probably pretty close to 100 years old. And a group of individuals have taken that over and are reimagining Carnegie to be a museum. And they will have artifacts of Hanford's history. They will have rolling exhibits, and it will be, you know, open to the public. It is, you know, the Carnegie Museum of Kings County. So it does belong to the county, although it's, you know, located in Hanford. Wonderful structure. It's got a nice garden area right behind, right on 6th Street there. So I, you know, it's going to be really nice. I believe they've been working real hard to get it cleaned up, to get the exhibits up for the weekend of the celebration. So that will happen on Friday at 12 noon. They will actually cut the ribbon. And then there will be a luncheon sponsored by the Hanford Chamber.
And then there are other events happening throughout the weekend. Just briefly tell us what some of those things are.
Well, Thursday night, it kicks off with a cake cutting at the Thursday night market. Then, as we mentioned, the Carnegie will open up on Friday at noon. At 2 o'clock on Friday, we have a sidewalk chalk art contest. So any young person is invited to come and draw their picture, their pictures and their paintings with chalk art on the sidewalk. At 6:30 at the steps of the Civic, we have a Battle of the High School Band drum lines. And then there'll be a sock hop Melco dance that evening at 7 o'clock. On Saturday, it's a full day. We start off with a community breakfast with the Hanford Breakfast Lions. There's going to be a classic transportation exhibit where all types of vehicles pre-1966 will be on display at the Civic Park. At 12:30, the official proclamation and celebration and recognition of our veterans will take place in front of the Veterans Building. From 3 to 6:45, there'll be community open houses. At 6:30 on Saturday, there'll be a beer garden and live music at the Courthouse Square. And then we kind of finish the whole thing up at 8:45 with movies in the park, and it will be Cars 3. So a lot of things happening. Also on Saturday, between 3 and 6:30, there are several community groups, the museum, the Fox Theater, the Art Center, the library, the veterans, and downtown kind of are hosting a community open house. And so people can go and visit those locations and enjoy art. Again, take tours through the Carnegie and the Veterans Memorial Building. So we think there's a little something for everybody in the family. So we're looking for a busy weekend.
Certainly sounds like it. You know, I live in Fresno, but one of my favorite things to do living in the Valley is to hop on the train and go down to Hanford for the day, just wander around, visit some of the shops, have lunch. It's a really charming town. What do you think is unique about Hanford? What makes it so special?
You know, I think, you know, the community of Hanford really cherishes its history, its storied past, and that's reflected in the many historic buildings that we have in and around Civic Park. You know, you've got the historic courthouse, which is on the Federal Registry of Historic Places, right next door, the Bastille, you know, the veterans, the Civic Auditorium will turn 100 in 2 years. So that's a 98-year-old building. And so those have all been preserved and upkept as kind homage, I think, to the history and the hard work that really made Hanford what it is. And I think that resonates with the community in many ways. You know, you've got, it's just a charming, old-fashioned park that you don't see too often. Maybe, you know, Sacramento up in the capital area, you might see something somewhat similar, but we think it's a very special place, and just the community really, really loves the culture and the history of what made Hanford, Hanford.
I've been talking with Brad Albert, the Parks and Community Services Director for the City of Hanford, about the 130th birthday celebration for the city that's happening this weekend. It's been just lovely talking to you, and have a wonderful time this weekend.
Thanks, and we invite everybody to come out and enjoy themselves.
And finally, Mohammed Ahmed has worked behind the register of the Food King in Fresno's Tower District for more than a decade.
He's the owner, and a lot of his customers are regulars, coming in every week for basic staples or beer. He expects to see them, but the pandemic changed routines and put added stress on his business. As part of our occasional series on how people are processing the magnitude of the pandemic, FM89's Alice Daniel spoke with him and produced this audio postcard.
It was something new that I have not experienced or seen anything like. So it was kind of like a new experience. You don't know how to adjust to it. You don't know what the rules are. And then it's just totally new. People came in at the very beginning of it with no mask on and not keeping distance and not believing it is for real. And, you know, you have to deal with all sort of people, people that will put mask on, people that will not put mask on. So it was totally different. It's stressful sometimes, but, you know, we manage it through it. You talk to them, but sometimes nothing goes through. People have their own beliefs. And, you know, you try to kind of, hey, look, there's other people besides you here. And, you know, if you don't care about yourself, those people do care about themselves. And they're not comfortable hanging around, you know, people that are not, you know, protecting or having a mask on. Yeah, that sort of things. It changes you because, you know people that come in here and then they don't show up no more. And then you ask, they're either sick or they probably passed away. I even know a couple that did pass away. It hits you, you know, you don't see the same face all the time, you know. You don't know, you never know who's going to be next. I was stressed out in certain situation where, you know, people come in here and you could see it on them. They don't say much, but you could see it on them. You know, they don't express it so much, but you feel it, their tone, their attitude. So what happened back in 1918 and with the Spanish flu, and I watch it a lot on PBS. They have documentary on it. And the documentary, what happened then, it's almost a repeat what happened now. Except now the technology is more advanced and we caught up with it really quick. I'm sure each one of us that went through it, it changed them in certain ways. I'm not sure what it changes me as for that particular time. But maybe later on, you know, I'll figure out what is it that, you know, that changes in me. You know, people always say life is too short. And you know what? That just sums it up, you know. You walk and you don't know what's going on. The virus in the air. The next thing you know, the person is not around. So that's basically how it is.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.